Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Beethoven's Eroica Symphony has symbolized genius, heroism, and for one homeless man, a form of escape. This is Soundcheck. I'm producer Joel Meyer, sitting in for John Schaefer. Later on today's show, the Brooklyn folk rock group called Hymns makes music reminiscent of Pavement and Wilco with a dash of Neil Young thrown in. They'll play live for us. But to begin, in 2005, Los Angeles Times columnist Steve Lopez was strolling through a gritty part of downtown L.A. when he stumbled across Nathaniel Ayers, a homeless man with schizophrenia. As it turned out, Ayers was also a Juilliard-trained musician who was creating classical music on a beat-up violin with only two strings. Soon, Lopez began chronicling Ayers' life on the streets in his columns. The two men developed a friendship that changed both of their lives. Lopez documented the transformation in his new book, The Soloist. The book is now being made into a film starring Robert Downey Jr. and Jamie Foxx. And I'm pleased to welcome Steve Lopez to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Steve, while you were walking through the Skid Row area in Los Angeles, you saw Nathaniel playing. Why did you think there was a story there?
Well, he was actually playing adjacent to Skid Row in what's sort of the busy kind of financial district of downtown Los Angeles. It's a few blocks away from where it really goes off the deep end. But look, I'm a newspaper columnist. I'm in a, it's constant panic. Where's the next column? What are you going to write about next? You got to fill that empty space. So you're on the lookout, and anything is a possibility. And I see this guy, and, the violin's got only two strings. It looks like it's been pulled out of a dumpster. He's carved Stevie Wonder's name into the violin. He's got all of his belongings in a shopping cart. And, the clothes, the whole look, I thought, okay, this guy's got potential. What's the deal? So I go up to him when there's a break in the music. The other thing is that it didn't sound bad to me. I'm no musician, and I didn't know much at all about classical music, but I thought, he's missing two strings, and he's getting that out of this thing? So I went up and introduced myself, and he jumped back about 10 feet and was very wary of me, and I wondered how long it was going to take to get the story out of this guy. And I did hold him long enough to ask him, why do you play in this spot? And he pointed across the street and said, there's the statue of Beethoven. I can't believe that there aren't thousands of people standing around here playing because of the inspiration of this man. So that was the start of it.
Is this a spot you were searching for a column? Is this a place that you go to frequently looking for a story? I mean, Skid Row is, people know Skid Row as sort of just a generic term, but Los Angeles really has the Skid Row, like capital S, capital R.
We've got everybody beat when it comes to Skid Row. It's an unbelievable human landfill. And with every visit, I would come back and be unable to even know where to begin to describe it. Just thousands of people teeming. People with a mental illness, veterans, people falling out of wheelchairs in the middle of the street. You don't know if they're dead or alive. Drug dealers counting cash in the middle of the street. Prostitutes working out of porta potties, living in the porta potties. You know, all of this within a couple blocks of City Hall and a police station. It's just a bizarre scene.
Was it clear to you when you saw Nathaniel Ayers that he was mentally ill?
I knew that there was an issue. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know how severe it might be. And, he spoke reasonably well. It was just a few quick sentences before I realized I'd have to come back. And I did come back. I looked for him. And over the course of the next several weeks, with each visit, he warmed up to me a little bit more. And then we have the breakthrough moment where I see that he has scratched names on the sidewalk with a rock that he used as a piece of chalk. You know, Thomas and Albert and Rebecca and Sarah. And I said, Nathaniel, who are those folks? And he looks at me and says, those were my classmates at Juilliard. And I said, you went to Juilliard? And he says, yeah, that was a while back. It was ages ago. So I run back to the office and call Juilliard to see if indeed they've had a Nathaniel Anthony Ayers.
You check your facts.
You got to check it out, because at that point, I mean, he'd said a lot that there was a lot of non sequiturs and stream of consciousness, and it's not always strung together very cleanly. And I didn't know if it was a delusion, if it was a dream. And I went and I checked, and my heart fell because Juilliard said no, they'd never heard of him. And the next day they get back to me, they made a mistake. Yes, indeed, he did go to Juilliard. And that was the start of it. I write this column and readers reacted unlike they have to anything I've ever written. They started sending instruments, strings, money. My desk at the LA Times is surrounded by boxes with violins and cellos.
So, and well, that is sort of, that's a turning point in the story. You're a journalist, you're a columnist, and suddenly you become the steward of a number of different instruments, cellos and violins that are pouring into the LA Times offices, which I'm sure their facilities manager was happy about.
Yeah.
You know, at what point do you decide that you need to do something about what's going on?
Well, when I took the, I was so excited, I took the instruments out to him. I had no expectation of people digging through their closets and attics to come up with these things. But the emails were really touching. People said, look, I thought I might get back to this instrument someday, sometime. I'd rather that Nathaniel has this. Please wish him well. People were rooting for him and rooting for me to find ways to help him. So I take a few of these instruments out. And Nathaniel says, oh, great, and starts to put them into his shopping cart. And I said, oh, no, wait a minute. I'm not going to be able to sleep at night if I know that you're out here with all of these new instruments. Some of them in, you know, not new, but some that were in pretty good shape, even though they were used. And I said, I'm going to get a phone call from the police saying, hey, your buddy's been beaten for a violin and a cello. Nice going. So I told him, look, I'm going to keep these back at the office. He did not like that at all. And then I asked for some help. Does anybody in the office have any clue what I should do here? And I hooked up with a mental health agency called Lamp Community. And they came out and took a look, and they said, yeah, you got one on your hands here. And I said, will you guys keep the instruments? And I'll tell him when he wants to play them, he goes to Lamp. And they said, yes. So that was the plan.
In the book, you actually describe it kind of as bait, because in terms of as you get more involved in his rehabilitation and treatment, you start making kind of deals about access to the instruments and stuff like that. We'll get into that in just a second. We're talking with Steve Lopez. He's the author of The Soloist, A Lost Dream, An Unlikely Friendship, and The Redemptive Power of Music. Let's listen to a clip of the man that we're talking about, Nathaniel Ayers, here practicing. We'll talk with Steve more in a moment, but let's listen to Nathaniel Ayers practicing. Nathaniel Ayers, the subject of The Soloist, the book by Steve Lopez, who's my guest here on Soundcheck today. Steve, there are a number of people that end up becoming angels or people that you consult as you begin your friendship with Nathaniel and looking at how you can help him. Can you tell me, who are the people that you find out about his Juilliard history from? Because that's sort of the first thing that you have to piece together is what happened 33 years ago here
yeah.
in New York.
Maybe I should begin by explaining what you just heard. As you can tell, it's rough. It's a little bit crude. He didn't go to Juilliard with a violin. He went on upright bass. And when he crashed and burned, he couldn't lug a bass around in a shopping cart. So he worked at Wendy's in Cleveland and shoveled snow and saved up money to buy a violin and a flute. And he's been trying to train himself on these other instruments all of these years. The people who have, well, there are many angels in Nathaniel's life. The real break happened when I spent a night with him on Skid Row to see what he was up against. And the column I wrote was about a man who, after crushing cockroaches to clear a space for his bedding, looked up into windows that were lit and asked me, Mr. Lopez, do you think about writers the way I think about musicians? And I said, well, maybe not enough, Mr. Ayers. What do you mean? And he said, Beethoven and Mozart worked in windows like that once long ago. They lived and breathed as humans do. And they've created this thing that have inspired all of us for so many centuries. It's an inspirational thing. And he stood on the curb and recited the Hamlet soliloquy in a perfect Shakespearean accent. And he, as the last thing he did before going to sleep, took two sticks out of his shopping cart. On one, he had written Beethoven, and on the other, he had written Brahms. And I said, Nathaniel, what are you going to do with those? And he said, the rats are going to come up out of the sewers, I chased them away with the sticks. So I saw this, and, you know, he looked at me and handed me a blanket and said, "I hope you rest well, Mr. Lopez. I hope the whole world rests well." And I thought, what am I going to do with this guy? I'd never met a character like that. At that point, he was no longer just a column. He was somebody I was determined to help off the streets, and that's when I got a break. The L.A. Philharmonic called me, and they said, "You think Mr. Ayres would like to come up to a concert at Disney Hall?" And I said, "Well, I'll check with him and see what he says." And they were doing the third, which you led the show with. And rube that I am, I didn't know that the third was the Eroica. When I said, "Nathaniel, they're doing the third," and he, of course, said, "Oh, the Eroica." And I said, "Yeah, apparently that's what they call it." So we go up there, and as we got closer to Disney Hall, he mellowed out. He started out very confused and aggressive and kind of angry and wasn't sure he wanted to go. And we got closer, and I said, "You know what, Nathaniel, you've taught me so much about classical music. By now I'm buying CDs, and I'm going to go see Itzhak Perlman pretty soon with a National Symphony." And he said, "Oh, my God, he is molten lava on violin." And he looked at Disney Hall and said, "You know what, that looks like an iron butterfly." And we crossed the street. He runs his hand over the performance board, and he's touching Beethoven and Mozart like they're gods. And we go inside, and they sit us down in the empty auditorium, and the orchestra, the L.A. Phil, does the third. And Nathaniel leans forward in his chair and clenched fist goes, "Bravo!" And when they were done, a couple of the musicians, you know, pop down off the stage. Peter Snyder, a cellist, Ben Hong, another cellist, and they introduce themselves. And Peter, who's been with the orchestra, I think, about 36 years, offers to give him lessons. And he was stunned. I was stunned.
Why do you think that he did that? Why did he make that offer?
He had been reading about him, and like many readers, he was inspired by just the courage because, you know, Nathaniel's days, although he finds passion in every day, and I mean, this really is, it's you know, the story about human connections and second chances and the power of art and music. And it had sustained and brought Nathaniel peace, and Mr. Snyder and the other musicians were inspired by that. By the way, for Nathaniel, the music was pure love, and they were doing it as a job. And here's this guy who, you know, despite his circumstances, is as happy as anyone can be when he's in the embrace of the music. So that's what inspired them, and that's what got Mr. Snyder giving him the lessons, and that's when we use another tool here. The mental health agency at this point thought he was making progress, might come in, and they had offered him an apartment that he refused to step inside of. And Peter and I came up with a plot. Let's tell him that we'll do the lessons inside that apartment. We'll get him comfortable with it, maybe comfortable enough that he'll want to move in.
We're talking with Steve Lopez. He's the author of The Soloist. It's a book about the man that we've been talking about, Nathaniel Ayres, a homeless musician who suffered and suffers from schizophrenia. The Disney Hall is a place that he doesn't just visit once in the book. He comes back again for a performance of the Eighth Symphony. There is a remarkable and also remarkably funny moment in the book when maybe you can tell the story better than I can, but the audience is encouraged to be quiet during a performance, and it's not exactly what happens.
No, we're sitting with we're escorted to our seats now. He's such a VIP. When we go to Disney Hall, they take us to our regular seats. We go frequently to concerts. And one concert was going to be recorded live, and Adam Crane, the publicist, is one of Nathaniel's best buddies now. And he was also doing the PA that night, and he said, on the PA announcement, said to the audience, "Since this is being recorded, please be sure after each movement to wait and to, not after each movement, after the piece is complete, hold your applause until silence has returned to the room." There is one person who did not wait. Nathaniel could not contain himself. He's up on his feet. Bravissimo, bravissimo. So I think he made the recording.
All right, well, let's take a listen to the recording. This is the Los Angeles Philharmonic's recording of Beethoven's Eighth Symphony. We're talking with Steve Lopez, author of The Soloist, here on Soundcheck. Thank you. Beethoven's Eighth Symphony is recorded by the Los Angeles Philharmonic. In the audience was the man that we've been talking about with Steve Lopez, the musician Nathaniel Ayers, who is a homeless man that Steve saw on Skid Row one day in Los Angeles and began writing columns about, and it transformed into the book The Soloist that is now actually going to be a movie out later this year starring Robert Downey Jr. and Jamie Foxx. Steve, one thing I wanted to ask, you talked a little bit earlier about Nathaniel and his almost obsession with particularly Beethoven. It's a word that's peppered throughout his speech. He makes reference to Beethoven all the time. Why is Beethoven so important to him?
I think because, you know, this is a kid who grows up in a tough neighborhood in Cleveland. And he, against all odds, finds his way into the arms of a member of the Cleveland Symphony. Harry Barnoff was a bass player who trained Nathaniel and told him he could go far. And he got a scholarship to Ohio University and wanted, though, instead to go to Juilliard like Mr. Barnoff had. And, you know, worked at it and auditioned in his first year at Ohio, nails it, goes there. When you look at the transcripts and the juror comments on his performances, they're amazing. Everybody talks about this promising talent. And I think the expectation was that he might one day be in a major orchestra in the world. And so he's interested in orchestral compositions. That's part of it. And then here he is, kind of lost in the woods and stumbling around 30 years later, and comes upon a Beethoven statue as if it's a god. I mean, and that to him just meant everything. And he thought that it was put there for him on some level. He thought it was put there for him. And as he started to think about the music, and you know, for Nathaniel and people like him, the world is spinning out of control. And you're always looking for an anchor and for balance. And for Nathaniel, the notes on the music sheet have not moved for two centuries. Hmm. And when he goes there, he's safe and he's anchored and he's sane. And, you know, he's in his element. And I think that when he saw Beethoven, he remembered all of his, you know, his schooling, and how proud he had been to be a part of an orchestral production. So Beethoven just works for him.
We've talked a little bit about how he lived on the street. Let's talk about why he's there, the question that everybody asks when they encounter homeless people. You know, why is he there? Where is his family?
Well, his mother did the best she could, and his sisters had moved on somewhat. The one that he was closest to had moved to Atlanta. They knew that he had come out to look for his father and then kind of lost track. He's been reunited now with his family. His sister in Atlanta checks in regularly, Jennifer. But, you know, people are on the streets for lots of different reasons, and that's another part of this story. It's one more look at what we've created. And you look at Skid Row, it's not an accident. If you shut down mental institutions and you never follow up on the promise of the community clinics that were supposed to help people maintain lives with dignity and take the burden off family members that were not equipped or trained to deal with some severe illnesses, this is what you get. You get people on the streets muttering to themselves. And the important thing here, and I think what Nathaniel's story says, is that this is not a moral choice to live in the gutter chasing rats with sticks. I mean, the man needed help, and we in this country have not done a very good job. New York City, in fact, has done a far better job. The person who runs the clinic, the mental health agency where he stays in Los Angeles, came from the city of New York. And she said that New York City spends like three or four times as much on what's called permanent supportive housing, where it's not just a roof over your head, and it's not just the outreach workers to go out and try to, you know, gradually build some level of trust and lure people in. But then it's all the services that you need when you're there, whether it's psychiatric counseling or job training, whatever. So we just haven't done a very good job, and we've got people living on the streets to remind us that.
We're talking with Steve Lopez. He's the author of The Soloist. It's a book that he wrote after writing columns about a homeless musician named Nathaniel Ayers that he had met on Skid Row in Los Angeles one day. We've talked a little bit, Steve, about the strong response from the Los Angeles Times readership. People sent in instruments once they started reading about Nathaniel, outpourings of support from individual musicians within the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Let's talk about you and your strong response to this story. There are a lot of people in your position as columnists that might not cross the line that you did in terms of helping someone that they wrote a column about. Was that ever a concern for you, and how did you feel about it?
I felt like I had no choice. When I did the first story, and people sent instruments, and I realized I had to try to keep him safe. We developed a bond, and the bond was almost instant. From the very beginning, something about the man that I admired, and I began to think about things like the definition of happiness and of success, and I began to think about my own passion for what I do. He rekindled my interest in what I do. It's one of the many gifts. And, you know, one day he was wearing this T-shirt. It said, Yo-Yo Ma, Disney Hall, and it had a date. And I said, what's that, Nathaniel? And he said, Yo-Yo Ma is coming to town. And do you think we can get tickets? And I said, with you, yes, you can get tickets to anything at Disney Hall. You're a VIP. So we go up there for the concert. And when Nathaniel was at Juilliard, Yo-Yo Ma briefly was a classmate. And he had followed the career and thought about Yo-Yo Ma. After the concert, we go backstage, and Yo-Yo Ma is going to come in and see him, and Nathaniel's nervous. He's looking in the mirror. He's fixing his necktie, and Yo-Yo Ma walks in, goes over to Nathaniel, shakes his hand, and said, you and I are brothers. Anyone who loves music as much as you do is a brother of mine. We are brothers in music. He throws his arms around Nathaniel, gives him a hug, and then hands him his cello and says, I got to meet some other people. I'll be back in a minute. Why don't you give this thing a try? And there's Nathaniel standing there, and it's moments like that where, you know, I just feel so good about putting him in a position where he's back in that fraternity and he's back in his element. And there's, you know, it's like a state of grace that you feel when you open your heart to somebody and be patient enough to listen to his story and find ways to help. There's a lot that comes your way from that.
I think, you know, there's an interesting part in your book. We won't have a lot of time to get into it, but you mentioned the fraternity of musicians and Nathaniel's time at Juilliard. He's African-American, and during his time at Juilliard in the 1970s, he's maybe one of the only black people attending Juilliard at that time.
Yes, and if you put it back in that time, he left Cleveland when it was on fire. We've got the civil rights movement. We got the Vietnam War protests. And he goes there, and this is not a place at the time, Juilliard, where... it was the most welcoming atmosphere. Mm-hmm. It was sink or swim, good luck. And, you know, Nathaniel was under the same pressure everybody else was, but maybe a bit more because he wondered if there were those who were wondering if he was there for some reason other than his talent. So, you know, if you, it's believed by some people that you need a genetic predisposition if you are to have a full-blown experience like he had with schizophrenia. And that if you do have it, it can be triggered by, you know, pressure, trauma. And nobody will ever know what caused this outburst. But he was under a heck of a lot of pressure. And when I asked him about it, he said that he felt like, you know, he was alone. And he felt like he couldn't understand what was happening to him. And he felt like he didn't know who he could speak to about it. So it's possible that the pressure of that environment led to the breakdown.
Well, flash forward 33 years later, Nathaniel has had columns by you in the Los Angeles Times written about him, now a book, and now, coming up in the fall, a huge movie, a movie that's starring Jamie Foxx, an Academy Award winner, as him, and Robert Downey Jr. as you. Where is he now, and how does he feel about it?
He is still in that apartment. He still has good days and bad. He still has a long ways to go. Having been through shock therapy and straitjackets and handcuffs and jails because of his condition, he's still wary of anybody who tells him he should see a doctor. He's very lucky to have the music. He had it going in, and he's had it to sustain him ever since. But when he's not wrapped up in that, he can be very difficult. He can turn on me. Sometimes he's troubled by, you know, the exposure. Other times he's very proud to get a call from DreamWorks. Do you want to come over and perform for the cast and crew? And I thought that nothing would make him more pleased than to go to Disney Hall when a few weeks ago they shot the scene where Nathaniel and I went there to see the Eroica. And it's a huge production. The L.A. Phil plays itself in the movie. And Nathaniel's buddies are in the L.A. Phil, and Jamie Foxx and Robert Downey are going to be sitting in the seats that Nathaniel and I were in. So I go to get him, and he's out in front of Disney Hall playing the violin. And I said, okay, Nathaniel, here's our moment. Let's go in and see them shoot this thing. They're going to recreate this really great moment in our lives. And he looks at me. He looks up at blue sky, nice sunny day. He says, you know, I'm getting into a groove on this piece right here. I think I'm going to stay outside and play. And I said, Nathaniel, this is it. This is our big scene. Come on. And he says, nah, it's really nice. He said, maybe I'll come in later. So I walked up the stairs, and the producer, Gary Foster, said, "Is he coming in or not?" And I looked across the street and I said, "Gary, I think we picked the right name for the title of this thing. The soloist is happy as could be across the street in his own world, fiddling away."
Last question. We just have a few seconds. Do you still talk to him? Do you still see him?
We talk a couple times a day. We visit a couple times a week. We go to concerts. We go to ball games. He called me this morning to tell me he's working on the Elgar Cello Concerto, the Bach Partita, and a couple of Ernest Bloch pieces, because he's got a session coming up with the pianist, a violinist, and a cellist on April 30th in a practice room at Disney Hall.
We'll leave it there. We'll go out with Elgar's Cello Concerto, one of the pieces that you just mentioned, being performed by one of Nathaniel's classmates at Juilliard, Yo-Yo Ma. Steve Lopez is the author of The Soloist, A Lost Dream, An Unlikely Friendship, and The Redemptive Power of Music. Steve, so thanks so much for coming on Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, True Confessions of a Soundcheck Listener. We'll share some of your dirty musical secrets. Then later, the band Hymns plays songs suggesting 60s country rock, even though they live right here in New York. They'll perform live in our studio. This is Soundcheck.